Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
There's a kind of funny balance in the city of when you're always with people and yet there's still the sense of anonymity and being by yourself.
Roz Chast's cartoons began appearing in The New Yorker in 1978. Since then, she's published hundreds of cartoons and written or illustrated more than a dozen books. All of them feature her zany, neurotic, slightly crazed characters. She's probably best known, though, for her 2014 graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and received the Kirkus Prize for nonfiction that year. Welcome to the show, Roz.
Hi.
So your new book, Going Into Town, A Love Letter to New York, is partly a guide that you wrote for your daughter when she was moving to Manhattan, and there are some very specific tips in the book. Did you always think you could turn the tips into a book, though?
That was not at all on my mind when I made the booklet for her. I really, as I said in the book, I did not want her and Manhattan to get off on the wrong foot. And I thought that there were just some like basic pieces of information that she should know before she moved there for college, and things that sometimes they skip over in guidebooks. You know, they tell you, usually in guidebooks, they tell you places that you should see, but they don't tell you about like the sort of layout of the city, like how it's kind of just basically organized.
Yeah.
You know, so I wanted to tell her, like, okay, here are the avenues, here are the streets, it's basically a grid. And she did not know what I was talking about. And so I drew out a little sketch. I got a piece of typing paper and I did this little sketch of, okay, here are the avenues, they go vertically and they're a little bit farther apart than the streets, and the streets go horizontally. And Fifth Avenue divides the east side from the west side, just things I thought she should know. And I said, you know, so if you want to walk from 43rd Street to 47th Street, you walk up four blocks. And she actually said to me, what's a block? and then I realized, you know, I had a ways to go.
Because
she grew up in suburbia.
Right. But not knowing a block is, you know, you had to start with the basics, right?
Yes, with the basics, with the very, very basics. So I made her this booklet, which was about, you know, maybe 16 pages and, you know, a sort of just sewn together in the middle, like a little single signature folio, I think they call it, and that she could stick in her back pocket and carry with her. And at the end of 4 years, she gave it back to me, and it was quite well worn. And she said, and I had like scotch taped a couple of, you know, like a subway map and some other where the museums were, some information I thought she might be handy, how to hail a cab, you know, stuff like that. And she told me it had been very, very useful. And that was when I started thinking. But it took a little while, because at first I thought it would just be a little bit of a guidebook. But as I, you know, started to put it together and write it, I realized it was also a fan letter to New York. It was a mash note.
Right, right. And in the original booklet for your daughter, did you include your own cartoons?
No. I did do drawings, not like... Right. exactly cartoons, but I had lots of drawings in the booklet, you know. Yeah.
And so, I mean, the book is so interesting because it does, I mean, I could see, let's say, you know, a parent giving it to a child who is going to move to Manhattan from, I don't know, Kansas or somewhere to go to NYU or Sarah Lawrence or somewhere like that, Columbia. And, you know, yeah. being used in a very sort of, you know, specific and useful way, but it also has more personal pages and sort of moments for you from your history. Was it difficult to sort of, I guess, tie those two types of a book into one book?
Yes and no. I mean, I wanted it to have a sort of narrative feel, I guess, mm-hmm. to make some sort of coherent sense. So, yeah, I mean, it was, every book has its own, you know, questions and problems and things that you have to think about and try different, you know, ways of figuring, you know, it's just part of the process of doing it. So yeah. I mean, it took a while. It took a little while to figure out how I wanted to do it and what I wanted to do. You know, I had a sort of vague idea of what I wanted to do. And then as I worked on it, I thought, well, that is not what I want. And that is what I want, you know, some trial and error types of things.
And so you write at the end of this book that Manhattan is, quote, still the only place I've been where I feel in some strange way that I fit in. And I was wondering if that's still true and why that might be.
Oh, it's definitely still true.
Okay.
I'm aware of it every time I'm here. I think, I mean, some of it was best said by E.B. White in Here is New York, when he talks about there's a kind of anonymity and privacy. And I don't know, he uses the phrase the gift of loneliness. And I'm not even completely sure that I fully understand what he meant by that. But I don't know.
Probably in some sense, I mean, for a writer or an artist like you, I mean, being left alone is a little bit of a gift because you have time to think, right?
Yeah. And there's a kind of funny balance in the city of when you're always with people and yet there's still the sense of anonymity and being by yourself that, I don't know, it's very unique to me. And I feel it when I come here, this kind of relief. And I don't know, maybe it's also related to having grown up here.
Yeah.
And spent so much time here. And it's also probably helped along by the fact that when I'm here, I know I do not ever, ever have to drive. And I hate driving so much.
Right.
I cannot tell you how much I hate it.
Yeah. So you grew up in Brooklyn, and your parents, according to this book, didn't really like to linger in Manhattan. I mean, they would go in for a show or something, and they would quickly go home.
Yeah.
Which, of course, made me wonder.
Yeah, they'd scamper back.
Yeah. When you were a teenager, did you take sort of forbidden trips to Manhattan just to be rebellious?
Well, no. I mean, I was not to be rebellious. My parents would know I was going in. I went to the Art Students League here on I think it was like the first Saturday of every month.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in for that. Sometimes I would go in with a friend. We would, you know, or I'd go in by myself. I would make up trips for myself. I remember learning how to, you know, get up to the Cloisters by myself. And it was a long subway trip from where I lived up to the top of Manhattan, and how thrilling it was for me to sort of figure out how to do it and then do it, and that it worked. And I think I liked exploring in Manhattan. My father liked it somewhat when this was after I had gotten out of the house, and he was retired, and it was when he got older, he liked coming into the city. My mother didn't. I think she didn't like, she just was not interested in the same way.
Yeah. Well, there were cockroaches in the lasagna that Mrs. Zimmerman ate, according to your book. So.
Yeah.
You
get sick.
Yeah.
You don't know who's been handling, you know, the food.
One thing, your style, I mean, it's definitely all your own, which makes me wonder. I mean, when you were starting out, did you feel like your cartoons didn't fit in? I mean, when did you start to feel confident about your own style and your vision, because it's not like anyone else's out there?
I have really never felt that confident about it. I think still waiting for that to kick in. I don't know. I think that like it would be worse to try to imitate somebody else, you know.
I'm trying to imagine
that. Even more terrible. You know, it's funny. It's like occasionally I'll see somebody doing like a really glamorous drawing, like a fashion drawing of a glamorous looking woman, and I'll try to copy it, and it's just impossible. And I don't know what it is. It's like something, like some tiny line will be off in the drawing, and it will not look glamorous anymore. So I don't know what it is.
Yeah. And did you start submitting cartoons to the New Yorker early on, or did you kind of wait to do that, or?
No, and I've said this, you know, forgive me if you've read this somewhere else, but this is sort of, for me, when I was 23, I knew I wanted to draw cartoons. My goal of goals, my secret heart goal of goals was to be a cartoonist for the Village Voice, mm-hmm. because that's where I thought I would fit in the best. You know, they were using Jules Pfeiffer. I think at the time they were also starting to use Stan Mack and Mark Allen's Vanity. And somehow I felt like my stuff fit in there. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker, and I, you know, had grown up with it. So I knew they used cartoons, but I did not see how my stuff fit in there. And I never really thought that that's where I would find a home. One time I just called up and I found out when they had their, you know, over the transom, their drop-off day submissions. You know, it was on Wednesday, and I dropped off my stuff when I was 23. And when I went to pick it up the next week, you know, I was fully expecting to find a rejection note in there, but instead there was a note from Lee Lorenz, who is the art editor, to come back and see him. And they bought a cartoon, which completely floored me. And he told me, I mean, it was like, you know, am I dreaming? Is this a dream? He told me to start coming back every week with new work. So that's pretty much what I started doing.
That's a really great story and a really rare story.
Yeah, really, and still surprising to me. It's like, really? Wow, that's kind of odd.
Right. And so, I mean, you're so successful now, and you have so many fans, and you're really at the top of your game. But, I mean, do you still get edited? I mean, are there cartoons, for example, that The New Yorker doesn't take?
Oh, my God, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, when I say we, it's the cartoonists, you know, we submit new work every week, like six, for me, it's about six or eight drawings. And, you know, sometimes I sell one, sometimes I sell none. I didn't sell anything last week. Every blue moon, maybe once or twice a year, I'll sell two, but many weeks I don't sell anything. So it's still, you know, one thing that has stayed the same through, every editor and every cartoon editor is just the unpredictability of the whole thing.
Right. So now, how does your family feel about showing up in your work?
Well, with this book, I did talk to my, you know, kids about it, and my husband, and they were all right with it. I mean, I don't think I ever say or do anything, you know, write anything that's, you know, super personal. Or maybe it's just that they've gotten used to it over the years, that certain, you know, funny things are going to find their way into the drawing. But mostly with cartoons, they're more like blends of people. You know, it's with the books, you know, like going into town, there are, you know, things that were from life. But generally with the, you know, weekly cartoons, it's more like a blend of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask you how the success of Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant sort of changed your career. I mean, one thing that people love about that book is that it has, you know, the humor that we associate with you, but it's also quite serious, and it's about seeing your parents off to their deaths, basically. Has that opened up your career in any way? I mean, allowed you to be serious, for example?
Yeah, I'd say that there's some of that. I mean, I think also for myself, also as it's going to sound so pretentious, but as an artist, it's opened up another, you know, part of myself to work with and to draw about and write about. And, you know, that's good because the idea of doing the same thing over and over and over is, I don't think that's really good. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it was, again, you know, very surprising, but very grateful that people responded to it,
yeah.
You know, that it resonated with so many people.
Right.
So it's just, you know, and I guess it's also, it's not just your parents. It's like once you go through it with your parents, you know, guess who's next? Hey. You know,
it's like, right.
Yeah. Oops.
So, one of the things that is touching in this new book is that, you know, you write about September 11th, and you say sort of in the context of writing about September 11th that Manhattan is still the best place in the world. Can you talk a little bit about why you feel that way?
Well, oh golly, there's so, you know, infinite reasons I feel that way. For one thing, I think it really is more so than any other city in the United States and maybe in the world. It's an international city. I mean, it's part of the U.S., but, you know, occasionally my husband will say something to me, like, once we were driving and, I don't know, like, we were out in one of those areas where there's, like, malls and, like, shopping centers and gas stations, and it was suddenly, like, he was driving, I'm sitting next to him, it's like, where are we? Are we, like, in a town? Are we outside of a town? What is the name of the place that we are? And he just turned to me and said, you know, this is a shopping center. Welcome to the mainland. And, you know, and so I feel like there is this aspect of New York, of Manhattan, that is very unlike any other place. It is not like the mainland. It's international. It's this little island. It's extremely densely packed. It's crazy, crazy dense. It's multi-layered. You know, you will see, and of course, you know, if you go to Europe, you see things that are much older than like 150 years. That's like yesterday to them. But I love how you see, you know, a building, you know, from, I don't know, like 1900, and it's like jammed next to a skyscraper from yesterday. And, you know, and you're in the subway and it's like really disgusting. And, you know that this station is like from 1920 and yet it's still somehow operating. And, you know, I just find it so stimulating and so interesting and just more, I don't know, I just emotionally respond to it more than any other place I've ever been. And probably a lot of it does still have to do with not having to drive a car, which, as I said before, I really hate. I hate the driving thing, and I don't like, you know, having a yard, and I don't understand why anybody would want to own their own tree. And, you know, it's, I don't know. I like cities,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Do you think you'd feel the same love for Manhattan if you lived in Manhattan?
I do. Well, I have a little place here, so mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
a resounding yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this last photo in the book, which you also recreate on the cover of the book,
yeah.
It's a photo of you and your mom when you were a child about to get on the subway,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And the sign on the wall behind you all says, buy tokens at your leisure, with the word your underlined for no real reason that I can make out. And I just wanted to say,
I know.
It was really wonderful to see that photo because the underlining of the word your feels like such a Roz Chast kind of detail. And I guess
it's
all
so
these years,
weird, isn't it?
It is really weird. And it just made me happy to see it because I think all these years of reading your cartoons in The New Yorker, I thought you made up weird stuff like that, but it's actually real.
It is actually real. I mean, you saw those like standpipes. I had to take photos of them,
yeah.
Because like some of them, like I don't know if I don't know whether you got the book with the color pages mm-hmm. in it with a.
Yeah.
I mean, like if I tried to describe the standpipe with like 12 arms coming out of it, like somebody would probably think I was making it up.
Yeah.
But no. And people were just like walking by it, and I wanted to just like grab one of them like a crazy lady and just say, look at that thing, what is that?
Right. Well, thanks for this book. Really loved reading it, and I hope new people going to Manhattan all buy it.
Well, thanks. Thank you. Nice talking to you.
definitely, for me, the quote of the interview is, I don't understand why anybody would want to own their own tree. That's a winner.
I know. Well, and as someone with three huge post-oak trees in my yard who's always worried during storms that they're going to fall and kill me, I kind of see what she's talking about. And everyone keeps saying, oh, but they add so much value, so much monetary value to your house. Well, yes, unless they kill me.
Exactly.
So you're going to talk to Carmen Maria Machado. Is that right?
Yeah, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. Well, we're all excited because she is a finalist for the 2017 Kirkus Prize in Fiction.
I feel like we should have some joyous little music we can play, you know, for that. I feel like we should have some sort of, you know, let's work on that.
All right, should we call her up?
Let's.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Hello, Dick Enberg here, and I'm mighty excited to announce the start of my new show, Sound of Success, right here on Podcast One. For 60 years, I've rubbed shoulders with sports greatness, from athletes in the world of football, baseball, college and professional basketball, golf, tennis, the Olympics, and so much more. Join me as I explore in-depth stories from the greatest figures in the world of sport, and I'll share a few of my own. Download new episodes of Sound of Success every Thursday on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, and Podcast1.com. Oh my!
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Carmen Maria Machado's singular, sexy short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, left me gobsmacked and grateful, and I'm not the only one. The debut is longlisted for the National Book Award and shortlisted for our very own Kirkus Prize for Fiction. For a debut short story collection to ignite the literary world in this way is highly unusual, which would be an adequate way to sum up the book if you only had two words to do it. Her Body and Other Parties contains a fantastical variety of stories united by their bold considerations of female experience. Teasing and intelligent, lyrical and lush, Machado's stories are windows on worlds not too far from our own, but often funnier, fatter, queerer, or more voluminous. And I mean that especially in the sense of the word that is having many coils, convolutions, or windings. Machado is a teacher and critic whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, Guernica, Tin House, NPR, Electric Literature, and elsewhere. She lives in Philadelphia with her wife, but joins us today from the offices of Grey Wolf Press, her publisher, in scenic Minneapolis. Hello, Carmen. Welcome to Fully Booked.
Hi, thank you. That was the loveliest introduction in the history of mankind.
Good night, everybody. No.
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much for being with us here today, and congratulations on the critical embrace of this outstanding debut.
Thank you. Wow. No one is more shocked than me, but it's been really amazing.
Saying, you know, what wakes you up in the morning? The aroma of coffee or just the sweet smell of success?
I know, right? it's funny because I feel like I've been working on this book for so long and I've been writing for so long, and just suddenly for it to be like all out there at once is like a very strange and wonderful set of emotions.
And not only to be out there, but to be appreciated and celebrated like this is...
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So in our start review, our critic calls Her Body and Other Parties an exceptional and pungently inventive first book, which I loved. It is exceptional in many ways, this collection, and one being, it's rare that a modern short story collection doesn't take its title from a story therein. The last time I can remember encountering that, I think it was Kelly Link's excellent Get in Trouble. Why is your collection named for one of its stories, and why was Her Body and Other Parties the right title?
That's a great question. So the thesis that I did when I was at Iowa, which was at this point, oh God, five years ago? No, I graduated 5 years ago. So 7 years ago when I got there. The title of the book, I had like a series of stories that I call a collection and that actually has the same title as this book, but only has three overlapping stories. So if you looked at like the version that's in the, like, the University of Iowa library, you'd be like, what is this? but I actually was trying to figure out the title for my thesis and asked a friend, I was like, how do people name short story collections? And he was like, well, I think they usually like find a title from one of the stories that sort of encompasses the themes of the entire book and pick that one. So I was looking through the titles that I had, and none of them seemed to fit. Like I kept going through and saying like, okay, well, Real Women Have Bodies is like, okay, sort of like Difficult at Parties. Like, and I was just not certain what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what if I just mash them together? So I just started kind of like doing variations on like certain keywords from various titles and putting them together and seeing what happened. And I was thinking a lot about, I really love the Ted Chiang short story collection, Stories of Your Life and Others, you know, mm-hmm. where the and others sort of is a play on and other stories and also and other lives, right? It's sort of this double meaning. And so I was like, ooh, what if I just made the and other something like to, so that was sort of the structure that I sort of landed on. And then, yeah. And then I was like, Her Body and Other Stories. What about Her Body and Other Parties? I mean, it was just sort of this like, you know, very like me just mixing words around until it like sort of made sense to me. And then, yeah. And then I really liked it. It resonated. It like made sense. It was weird. Like it was like a weird and interesting title. I hate bad titles. This is like a real problem I have. Like, so I have lots of feelings and I can never say it to people. Like if I don't like the title of their book, because like, I don't want to like hurt their feelings. but I feel like oftentimes I'm like very frustrated by titling. And so I felt very pleased with that title and I've just stuck with it ever since. And luckily girls did not make me change it. So I just got to keep it.
The thing that really pleases me about this title as a reader is a great novel, or in this case, a great short story collection, has always seemed to me to be an invitation to a party, like one with unexpected guests, wild conversations, varied foodstuffs, perhaps a expensive cheese board, you know, fighting, vomiting, you know. Full-on revelation of her, right? And in other words, the party that is the human experience, right?
Right,
and,
right.
And compare that with having a female body in a patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. I often feel that's like hosting a party that people feel at liberty to crash.
I love that. That's amazing.
Well, that your book made me have that thought. Your collection invited me to reconsider my experience of being a woman and having a female body. The gloriousness and the gore of it, frankly. And what do you think of that characterization?
I mean, it's funny when I'm teaching, I often tell my students, if you're feeling stuck with like the plot of a story or whatever, try making a party scene, because party scenes are my favorite scenes in books and stories, because there's so much, like you can bring lots of characters together. There's this like physicality and aesthetic quality to it, depending on what kind of party it is, right? There's food, there's booze, there's drugs, there's sex, there's bad behavior. There's like, there's just like a lot of potential to like, for chaos and beauty and weirdness and uncomfortableness and vomit. And, you know, there's just like so many things that can sort of happen. And I feel like that sort of, you know, in a way it's like sort of this like neutral thing that like can sort of be good or bad depending on a lot of various sort of variables. Right. And I feel like having a body and having a female body is very similar, where it's like, you know, I mean, in my book, like there's a lot of nightmarish qualities to like having a woman's body. And there's also a lot of pleasure and beauty and wonder to it. So I feel like I like that sort of dual quality of a way of thinking about a party and then also a way of thinking about the body as like this wonderful, beautiful thing. And also this like terrifying thing, which is sort of my relationship with my own body. So I feel like it just like is like what's in my head, you know, that's what I wanted to write about.
I'd love to talk with you a little bit about language, and I'd like to do it through, if we may, your story titled The Resident. First, just to establish the ground, would you please tell our listeners what that story is about?
Oh, God. It's about so many things. I mean, the rough plot of that story is that a woman is accepted to an artist residency sort of up in the mountains. So she goes there and is working. It's her first one, and she's working on this book. And she is a sort of a peculiar character with like a lot of very weird ideas about certain things. I don't really know how to describe her. And so while she's there, there's just a lot of sort of uncanny, alarming, strange interaction that she has. Some of them seem somewhat supernatural. She's having sort of odd interactions with the other residents. She's remembering that this is sort of roughly the same place where she went to Girl Scout camp when she was a young woman, and is sort of thinking a lot about that experience, like being a young woman. And she's sort of thinking back about like her, you know, various relationships with other girls, and also she's gay. So like there's sort of this very like discussion of like sexuality in there. Yeah. So, but it's sort of of like a horror. I wanted to like set a horror story like in a really faraway place. And I was like, what better place than a writer's residency? yeah. So I think that covers it. I guess that's what more or less what it's about.
Okay. So this story, like its fellows, includes some sumptuous choices in language. One random paragraph I pulled out is, "Then I noticed the car behind me, a low white behemoth that hovered too close. I felt a strange spiral behind my navel, the downward swirl that might precede fear or arousal. Then there was a change, which I perceived before I understood it. Red and blue lights spilled into my car." And you're writing about being pulled over by the cops.
Yes.
There's a lot of ways to say my character was pulled over by the cops. I think that this is an exceptional one. Why do you choose to use words in an expansive way? It's kind of, to me, it was kind of like an anti-Hemingway.
Oh, that's funny you'd say that, because I have a lot of feelings about Hemingway that I won't go into, because then that'll be the whole call. but you know, it's fun. I mean, I definitely think that there's like, I mean, there are lots of different ways to write that I think people can appreciate. Like, I can definitely appreciate a very sort of minimalist, very spare, sort of stripped back language. Like, that's not like I don't like that. But for me, like, I really like muscular, juicy language. Like, that's what I like to sink my teeth into as a reader. If it's done well, it's like just this really like intoxicating, like heady experience. And I take great pleasure in it. So there's sort of an aesthetic level that I just find that like I want to write that way and I want to read that way. So there's that. But also, you know, I'm very interested in sort of the musicality of language. I mean, I come from like a storytelling tradition in my family. And, you know, it's not just about what you're saying, but how you're saying it, right? That's like a really important way. And when you think about like, you know, if you think about like an actor, like you can just stand up and like read something or you can perform something. And I feel like I want to be performing the story I'm trying to tell. And also in a way that is very honest and true to whatever story I am telling. So like in her case, like I feel like in that story, the language is particularly Baroque because that's sort of her, that's like what's inside her head. That's how she thinks.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to like be very true to that and like let the language do some of the heavy lifting for like characterization, for example. So yeah, but also it's just the kind of writing I really like to read. Like I love learning new words when I read. Like it's very exciting to me when I like read a word I don't know. I mean, I remember being a kid and like reading, I think I was reading A Little Princess by Francis, Francis Burns Hodget. And I'm really having to look up 5 words a page because, like, you know, it's a pretty old, it's an older book. And, like, I had to look, and I loved it. Like, I would go to the dictionary and be like, what is this? And then I, like, knew a new word, you know? So I feel like I also really like that quality of, like, the prose sort of, like, inviting a reader to, like, think and participate and, like, dive in and kind of mess around in it. Like, I feel like that I really like that experience as a reader and as a writer. So, yeah.
It's interesting about words because I noticed a lot of things are curling in this collection or cupped, coiled, and otherwise wrapped up to the point where it, for me as a reader, it was almost incantatory. Like that, I was like, why is that? These cupped, curled things.
Oh, that's such an interesting, you know, I feel like it's sort of like saying, like, I noticed this symbol, like, showing up throughout. I mean, I feel like it isn't, I definitely cannot tell you that's intentional, but I think, you know, every writer has their, I mean, I definitely have noticed going back through my work that there are, like, certain images that I'm really interested in, certain things I like to describe in certain ways. And I think that's just, like, me as like a person in the world. Like, it's just like, this is how I think about a thing. And so it's just like, that's the way that I think to describe something. So clearly there's something about this image of like coiling or curling that like is very attractive to me in my mind. And so it's just like, it's sort of what bubbles to the surface, like when I'm writing. So yeah, it's not intentional, but I feel like that's absolutely a thing that I probably do. I totally believe you. Like that's a thing I do.
Thanks. I was focused on bodies. I mean, we have body in the title. It just, to me, kind of made me think of a fetus or a homunculus, you know?
Oh, I love like, that. No, totally. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like I am really interested in sort of like, you know, it's funny, like my aesthetic is very busy. Like if you look at like where I live or like this, like the way I would decorate a space is very sort of like detailed. Like I feel like it's like a thing that's very interesting to me sort of visually. So it's very, I feel like that sort of imagery and like, I like really organic imagery. Like I love like old anatomical drawings and I love like sort of rich, like old botanical illustrations. And like, I like the sort of organic imagery. And so I feel like that probably is just like, it's what I want to describe as a writer. Cause it's like aesthetically, that's like what I'm interested in as a visual person.
You also have a photography background?
I do. Yes. I was a photography major in college.
Hmm. What do you like to shoot?
Well, nowadays, the two ways that it sort of manifests in my current life is that I have a really nice Instagram account, and I also do author photos sometimes. Like when I was living in Iowa, like a lot of my friends needed author photos, so I would just do like cheap author photos for them. So mostly that's what I do. I mean, I really do like. It's funny because Instagram is actually a nice way where I can sort of channel that. Photography, the desire to like create images, and like I do think in images, and you know I sort of like will come up on a scene and like know sort of how to frame it. I mean, I think it's just like leftover from my training, you know. So I feel like there's just like a great pleasure in that. I don't do a ton of like fine art stuff anymore just because I don't really have the time. But I sort of like to imagine that like one day I would go back into it. So yeah.
Speaking of go back into, let's dive back into the book. Would you please tell our listeners what the story Especially Heinous is about?
So Especially Heinous is a surreal retelling of the first 12 seasons of Law & Order SVU, using the episode titles as jumping off points for sort of interconnected microfictions. So it's sort of like a Lynchian hellish recap of a non-existent version of a show that you know and love. I guess that's probably the way I would describe it.
I'm glad you greeted that question with a laugh because I thought it was very, very funny and grotesque. I mean, you take a show with a tremendous body count to the point where the tragic becomes comic, you know, after like you were just a nerd to it. And I mean, aren't bodies so great and gross?
It's true. No, it's absolutely true. And I feel like that is a thing that really is fascinating to me, is like that sort of like the monstrosity of it, the gross sort of the visceral way of it, and like the beauty of it and the pleasure. I feel like those things are all very much like they're all true, like they're all just like parts of the experience of the body. And yeah, and I felt like that story demanded a little bit of levity considering considering how much I talk about rape and sexual violence and assault and murder. And I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty relentless, so I feel like I had to sort of like cut it with some lightness as much as possible.
I was very careful with my conjunction in saying great and gross because I saw that you have a rather incisive critique of Ruth Franklin's biography of Shirley Jackson, and it centers on a big butt. And I was wondering if you would tell our listeners a little bit about what you discovered in reading that Shirley Jackson biography. What most of us might have read as an innocuous conjunction, you explored a little more in depth.
The discussion of her on the couch, is that what you're suggesting?
Mm-hmm.
Is that it isn't so much an indictment of the biography, which I actually enjoyed very much, but rather there was a quote within the biography where a friend of the Jackson family was describing Shirley at a party and said something to the I don't have the quote in front of me, I'm gonna mess it up a little bit, but to something to the effect of like she sat on the couch. She took up half the length of the couch, i.e. she's very fat. I mean, that's the implication. But she was so brilliant. I remember just like being flabbergasted, like just my jaw. Again, like that's not Ruth Franklin. That's
totally
the person who was being quoted. Yeah. But it was just, there was something about that where I was like, how is it that we are so sort of demented in the way we think about bodies and fatness that like you can say something like, oh, they were clearly very brilliant, but also they were fat, but don't worry, they're brilliant, you know? And I feel like that idea, I mean, I feel like obviously it's not, I mean, I'm not the first person to point out that like we'd like to associate like fatness with stupidity. I mean, think about like every movie in the 90s, which is like the fat bumbling character, right? You know, it's funny. In our household, we do this thing where where friends come over and we watch movies from like our childhood. So like the 90s mostly. And it's so fat phobic. Like every film, I mean, like every film we watch, it's like, there's always something super homophobic in it. And something super fat phobic. And it's sort of astonishing. You know, that it's just like people, you don't even notice it. Cause it's just so like ingrained, that idea of like the sort of this bumbling, stupid, fat character. Fat characters don't get their own stories, and they're just a punchline. And so, yeah, so that was just shocking to me because like Shirley Jackson's like one of the greatest American writer, you know, contemporary American writers. And like, here's this person just being like, oh yes, well, she was fat, but don't worry, she was really brilliant too, which is astonishing. That's an astonishing sentiment. I'm still just flabbergasted at it.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking. Yeah. It shocked me when you pointed it out. And that made me realize that you're really an excellent critic too. And so I wanted to ask you, as a writer of both fiction and criticism, and those skill sets don't always overlap like you think they might, is it necessary for you to compartmentalize those processes, or does the critic ride your shoulder like a proverbial angel or demon when you write fiction?
I mean, I feel like the critic, my critic's sort of eyes is more or less always on. I mean, ever since I was, I'm one of those people who, like, you know, when I was a kid, I was that outraged child, like demanding justice and like yelling about that. I mean, I've always been that person who like had a sense of fairness and rightness and like thought a lot about like what I was looking at and like tried to think about it in a critical way. That's just like my personality. So I feel like it's really hard to like, I can't really shed that. So, you know, even when I go to movies and things, like, you know, it's funny, I'll come back from like a movie and I'll come back and if my wife didn't go with me, I'll like come up to her and be like, let me tell you all about this movie that I just saw. And like, here are all the things I liked and didn't like and like the problems I noticed. And like, I wish they had done this thing. And if it were me, like I would have done this thing. And I mean, this is just like the way that I think. So yeah, so it's pretty hard to like shed that instinct. Luckily, I don't think it doesn't really slow me down as a writer. I think it makes me a better writer. Because I think I'm able to like think about the art that I consume where I sense that there are failures or successes and either model or reject those things that I saw or read. So I think it actually is very helpful. And I think that, I think it actually does like help me be a better writer.
Well, the result is nominated for a National Book Award and the Kirkus Prize for Fiction. So I think a lot of people agree. That is our time today on Fully Booked. Is there anything else, though, you'd like to mention to our listeners about the book, or are you feeling good?
I'm feeling pretty good. Thank you so much.
A lot of body talk.
Yeah, I think that this is a really exciting collection. It, you know, I'm a marginalia person, Clay. I write all over my books, and I knew I wanted to reread this, so I switched to a yellow pen because, I mean, it makes the notes really hard to see, but now I can kind of like consume it and enjoy it again without kind of all of my interventions.
Nice. That's great. You know, in the early days of galleys, I mean, I'm talking like back in the 1930s, the critics had to return the galleys to the publishers.
Whoa. And like on horseback or?
Yeah. So let's just be thankful that you do get to write in the margins of your galleys.
So thankful.
Yeah. Should we call the editors up?
Let's do it.
It's that favorite time of the podcast where we bring on our senior editors. Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. Vicki Smith is our children's and teen editor. And Eric Liebetrau is our nonfiction editor. And they and their critics are constantly monitoring the bestseller list to let us know whether we should spend any time reading the bestsellers. So, Laurie, what's happening in fiction this week?
Well, I was really happy to see on the bestseller list this week, Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, which is a book I know we talked about last week when you interviewed her.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a wonderful book. I was happy to see it selling so well. It's for, you know, if you didn't hear it last week, it's a book that's set in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which kind of sees itself as the perfect suburb, a kind of utopia on earth. And it's set around two families, the Richardson family, who's a kind of upstanding, longtime Shaker Heights family with four kids in high school. And the mother, Mrs. Richardson, has a little house that she inherited from her parents that has two apartments that they rent out. Just, you know, they don't need the money. So she likes to look for people who she can feel that she's helping. So she's just got a new tenant named Mia Warren, who's an artist, who also has a teenage daughter named Pearl. And when these two families kind of start interacting, the children become friendly and Mia starts cleaning house for the Richardsons. Just explosive things happen and it changes their lives and many other lives around them. And it's just, the book kind of has everything. It's beautifully written. It's got a great plot, great characters, you know, lots of issues to talk about. It's just really a terrific book. And I would recommend it to just about everybody.
Yeah, so much going on in that book. And I really enjoyed talking to her at Book People last week. I mean, also just a great publishing story. I mean, she, when her novel, Everything I Never Told You, was published in, I think, 2014, it just kind of seemed to come out of nowhere and it just sold, you know, she really got a name for herself. So that was a very positive story to see. So that's a book we love. What's one maybe we could reasonably skip?
Well, I think the book we skipped this week is called Secrets and Death by J.D. Robb.
Okay.
This is the 45th entry in a series of mysteries. So, you know, if you've read 44 of them and you love them, maybe you can.
Otherwise, you don't need to finish that sentence.
Well, you know what? Some listeners might not know that J.D. Robb is another, it's a pseudonym for Nora Roberts, who's one of the biggest writers out there. And if you're interested in Nora Roberts, if you're a fan or if you want to try her, she's actually got another book coming out in December, which isn't part of this series. And we're just giving that a starred review, and you might want to wait for that one.
What's it called again?
Year One. It's kind of dystopian novel.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Turning now to children's and teens literature. Hello, Vicki Smith.
Hey there, Megan LaBreeze.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. What's tops in children's and teens literature this week?
Well, we are loving They Both Die at the End by Adam Silvera. It's a book that really consciously gives the finger to the trope where the queer kid dies at the end of the book. By having both his main characters start the book knowing that they have 24 hours and then they will die at some point in that 24 hours. And they don't know each other, but they meet through a social networking app for people who are about to die. And
what's it called?
It's called They Both Die at the End. The app is called Last Friend. So lonely people who are about to die can have one last friend. And so one character is a Cuban-American foster kid named Rufus, and he's sort of rough and tumble. He's very thoughtful, but he's sort of a man of action. We meet him beating somebody up. And then the other character is a Puerto Rican boy named Mateo, who is he's almost agoraphobic. I don't think that's actively diagnosed, but he doesn't like to leave the house. He's really into video games. His dad is in a coma. His mother died in childbirth. So he's all on his own. And just sort of in desperation, he puts out a last friend request. And then the two kids, who are very unlike each other, but they have this fairly immediate and intense bond thanks to their imminent death, they spend the day together in New York doing some things that are sort of phony for people who are about to die and some things that are very, very real and heartbreaking. And you see these characters in their 24 hours, you see such full rounded life that it really is saying, you know, screw you to all the books where the queer kid dies at the end. Rufus is bisexual, which is how the queer kid happens to come into the story. So
man,
really lovely.
I love an unlikely idea that just gets backed up, you know, like this, if someone were pitching me the idea for this book, I'd say that's kind of wacky, but I'm so excited to read that one.
You should be. It's really very sweet. And make sure you have a hanky nearby.
Thank you for the pro tip. So what mightn't we want to read this week?
Well, we aren't loving It Takes a Village, which is not Hillary Clinton's 1996 book about the responsibility that a community has toward the children within it, but is in fact a picture book that is nominally on the same theme, but really, the text is so attenuated that it just reads like a bunch of platitudes.
Hmm.
And the visual narrative that Marla Frazee, a very talented illustrator, has concocted for it is sweet. It's about how a community gets together and builds this awesome playscape with the inspiration of three kids and with the participation of many generations and many races in the community. And it's really lovely. She does that kind of narrative beautifully. She's done it before in a book called All the World by Liz Garten Scanlon, and she actually won a Caldecott honor for it. But although it works thematically together with the whole notion of a village and kids, it doesn't really do anything to expand on the meaning of the African proverb that prompted the original book that talks about how we all have a real social responsibility for kids. So it's pretty, but it really punts the real meaning that it seems to be trying to convey.
Okay, so maybe pick up All the World instead.
Absolutely, pick up All the World. It's a beautiful book.
Thanks, Vicki.
So, Eric, how are we doing in nonfiction?
Doing well. I really like the bestseller list right now. There's not a right-wing nut job to be seen. No Savage, no O'Reilly, none of that. Right. It's all Hillary Clinton and Al Franken. And my choice this week is Unbelievable by Katie Turr, the NBC News correspondent who covered the presidential campaign and spent more than 500 days on the road with Trump. Grueling would be an understatement for that. So she recounts what she calls the most unlikely, exciting, ugly, trying, and all-around bizarre campaign in American history. And I think anybody who paid the least bit of attention would have to agree with that. And it's a really good, not very long, but well-written and insightful, you know, behind-the-scenes look at the campaign.
Yeah, and everyone's buying that book, too. It's
Yeah, it's doing very well. It's up to number two, just behind Clinton's book.
Yeah.
What's so interesting to me as a journalist is the fact that that is like a real bottom-of-the-barrel scraps assignment when it started out. Like, you have to cover the Trump campaign. It's like, womp, womp. That's basically the equivalent of you have to cover the school board.
Yes, and of course, she didn't expect it to last very long.
As exactly.
As many pundits did, but it was certainly life-changing for her.
Yeah. Yeah. Now she has her own show on MSNBC.
She does. Yeah.
And so what's not so great in nonfiction this week?
Well, I don't want to keep beating the Trump horse, but I'm going to. This one's called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very uneven. And essentially, our reviewer said, read collectively, the essays become repetitious. You know, they're leaning on the same definitions of narcissism and paranoia. And a lot of these things are very obvious. But ultimately, you're looking at a book that's going to shore up the opinions of those of us who disagree and those of us who don't think he's fit for the job. But, you know, not a single one of his supporters is likely to read it.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, it brings into question this idea that's been debated, you know, whether it's really ethical to diagnose someone from afar, you know?
Right. And that's like a separate argument that continues to play itself out. And basically they just took this and kind of threw these 27 together who were willing to contribute to the book.
Right, right. All right. Well, thanks, editors. That is this week's podcast. Next week, we are going to be talking to the astronaut, Scott Kelly, has a new memoir called Endurance. He did live at the space station for a year, so his book is titled Endurance. He knows what he's talking about. So you all know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey, it's Adam Carolla. Now, if you're hearing my voice, it means you like podcasting. And if you like podcasting, well, then you're going to love my show. Lots of funny segments, good bits, great guests, and of course, moi. That's Mexican for me. So check it out at Podcast One, iTunes, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. The Adam Carolla Show. Throw it on your phone. It's free.